I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. Have you ever wondered how an actor deals with the intensity of inhabiting their character's personality and physical being? How do stage actors deal with playing a role night after night? And how do they let go of that character and return to themselves and then real life? And what if the character they play experiences some kind of emotional trauma? Are they impacted by that as well? Well, tonight I am thrilled to have two professional actors with me in the studio to explore these questions and more. Both actors are from the East Coast and are here in Juneau starring in the Perseverance Theater production of Cyrano de Bergerac. Welcome, Katie Teckel and John Keebler. Yes, so let's start off with Katie. And please tell me a little bit about yourself and what led you to become an actor.
Sure. So I grew up in Northern California. I live in D.C. now, but I'm from the West Coast. And I guess it would be fair to say that it was something I always did. It was my extracurricular activity in school. I took my first acting class when I was in fourth grade in an after-school program, and that and art classes were sort of the things I did after school and the way I eventually came to spend my time and how I self-identified and ultimately how I came to understand the world. So that was really how I found it, and it was always very process-oriented. I liked being in drama club. I liked being rehearsing a show and being in a cast, and that was what I did. And then I went to college. It was one of my majors. I also double majored in anthropology. So I guess my college years were a little bit of a departure. Usually, I think somebody who has that path, while you major in it, you also spend a lot of time doing plays and stuff in college, but I didn't really do that. I maintained the credits to keep the degree, but I was more of an anthropology student. And then when I graduated, I moved back home to Northern California in San Francisco and just started auditioning and started working. And then I did that for a number of years until I made my way to the East Coast. My now husband went out there for work. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I would check out the theater scene in D.C. and came to find out that everything that you could ever want as a theater actor is there. Classical, contemporary, children's stuff. It's great. And that was how I found my way to D.C. And we've been there for a number of years, about 5 or 6 years. And I know the director of Cyrano from D.C., and that's how I found my way here.
Okay, any connections with Arena Theater? As you know, Juno.
Yes.
Juno's Molly Smith is famous.
Yes, I do know. Uh-huh.
And so that didn't have anything to do with you
coming
here.
No, not at all. I mean, I only knew about Perseverance because I knew that's where Molly started.
Okay.
And I've done some workshops, but we've never worked a lot together, so that was not how it happened at all. It was just sort of by chance.
So I'm not at all surprised that Molly made it to the big time in D.C. because I moved here at the beginning years of Perseverance Theater. And I will tell you, first of all, I came kicking and screaming because I thought I was a big city girl. And I was very much into theater as a audience member.
Right.
And I remember it just almost saved my soul. Those plays that Molly and her then husband produced and put on were absolutely brilliant. I mean, they were amazing.
Yeah, she's a star.
And so her talent is just fabulous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how you got into it.
Yeah.
And that's how you ended up in Juneau for a couple of months.
Yes.
And then in Anchorage. Okay, then you'll be going on to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
John, what led you into a theatrical career?
It's a good question. I didn't grow up with it. I got into it in college. I played sports all through high school and college. And so when I realized that my dreams of professional soccer playing was not going to be fulfilled, I really didn't know what the heck I wanted to do with my life. And so I was just driving around one night. I had dropped out of college. This is my third college. I heard this community theater on a local NPR station have auditions, and so I wrote it down, and I went in there the next week and auditioned, and I kind of caught the bug, and it's sports and theater, I feel, are very similar in the sense that you have to use your mind and your body and your like it's very
and they're team sports
absolutely, And so it just clicked. I found a home and things that I really loved doing, and so I just kind of took off from there and just kind of kept it going.
And but what are you doing in New York?
In New York, yes. Yeah. Yes, I'm in New York.
What kind of acting do you do in New York?
It's called serving.
Waiting tables.
Waiting tables.
Okay, so you have a day job?
Well, no, I don't. When you move to New York, and most of the time when you move to New York, you do most of your work outside of New York, especially in theater. Broadway world has changed. They want a star, or they want you have to have a voice to be on Broadway, or you do off Broadway and you can't support yourself because you're making $350, $400 a week. Mm-hmm. I did do a show in D.C. Years ago and fell in love with D.C. and was like, okay, I'm moving down here. The community there is incredible.
Really?
Yes. And the actors that I knew, they were like, yeah, I got this show and then that show after that and that show after that. I'm like, they just line them up because most of the theaters down there, they bring actors in from the community who live there, and they don't have to house them. So everywhere we go, if we're outside of our city, we have to be housed, and they have to give us, you know, a certain amount of amenities to support ourselves. So in D.C., all the actors there live there, and I think the theater can support themselves a little bit better that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So you live in D.C.? I thought you said you live in New York.
No, I live in New York, but I work in D.C., and so...
Oh, yeah. You mean you just... Why don't you move to D.C.?
Well, I've been thinking about it for years. I might just do that. Well, you know, you go to New York or L.A. for a lottery ticket to go up there and see if you can get in a film TV. Get on the Broadway show, and when after a while, just like playing the lottery, you're like, all right, this is I'm wasting my time and money.
Like we'll often say in D.C., you know, you're not going to win the lottery in D.C., but you might be able to build a life that has some kind of balance and stability.
Right. Yeah.
And those are the trade-offs. But you're not going to get, like, a massive, you know, film or Broadway ticket or anything like that. So those are kind of, I think, early on in your career, those are the choices that you make, which are, do you want – and usually a lot of people make them when they're younger, you know, like when you have sort of the stamina and the ability to wait tables and kind of go all in for a handful of years. But after like a decade or 15 years of doing that, you know, actors are people. So you just start to crave, I think, some more stability or more support or a place, you know, to sort of flesh out the rest of your life. And so I find that there's a natural point that actors hit where you start to really question, do I want to stay and keep trying to win this? Or do I maybe need to try something else? And I think that's different for everybody.
Well, would then that mean that other cities that are significant, like Chicago, would have a similar ethos where you're not going to get famous, super famous?
I think it depends. So, and John, you probably maybe have your own opinions about this. But so Chicago is also a really excellent theater town. I think it's not similar to D.C., but they're alike in that they have really strong local communities. I've never worked in Chicago. I've visited a couple times. But from what I've heard, you really need to be kind of come up through the ranks in Chicago to really be working there. And if you do, and if you're a Steppenwolf kid, you know, eventually that might lead to something else.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of a hard town to break into after you've been working for a long period of time is sort of what I've heard from friends. D.C. is a little different in that it's really exploded over the last 10 years. It was always great, but it's really, really sort of hot right now, and a lot of people are coming in.
So you mean it's because DCers are more likely to go to the theater? It's more there's more support for the arts?
A little bit of both. I mean, sometimes it's just a numbers game. I mean, if there's more work, if there are more contracts, if there's more opportunity, and you keep landing jobs and you keep working – you get better. It's just you know what I mean? It's like
it's
time
true.
In the ring. If
That's
you're in New
true.
York and you're auditioning for everything, but so are, you know, 10 times the amount of people, and you're scoring one job once every 9 months,
you're not getting better.
That's not the same kind of muscle work as it is in D.C. or another community where you can go from show to show to show to show and you just keep growing and you keep learning. And so then at the end of the day, you wind up being stronger and better, and people start pulling from their own community because you've got the talent.
I do think the political game in D.C. changes the theater scene there, too, because there are young staffers and there's a young, vibrant audience there that is unlike any other city in the country.
Agreed.
People come to New York to see Broadway shows. They want to see stars, but D.C., people are there, and they support the local theater.
And it's a town of ideas. You know what I mean? I mean, it's the political center of the world, you know? And so it's like with that comes a community that is politically active, that is intelligent, that is hungry for a certain type of, like, social discourse that happens through the arts.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. So let's get a little psychological here, guys. And truly, this is something that I've pondered. It's about inhabiting your role, and mm-hmm. it's about getting into the role and getting out of the role and maintaining the role. Because how many shows would a normal run have, would you say?
Mm. So depending on the contract or theater you're at, it can be anywhere from 8 shows a week from,
oh my
which would
gosh.
Be 4 weeks okay. to up to maybe, depending, I don't know,
right.
12 it's, or 16 weeks.
Right. It's usually
that's not including rehearsal.
Over. You know, because yeah. I wondered, you know, don't you get bored? And
well,
okay,
that,
so that's
yeah.
the other part mm-hmm. of it. How do you keep it real
yeah.
and juicy? So let's start out with how do you get into the role?
Mm-hmm.
So who wants to?
John, handle that, John.
Well,
first,
I find for me, I get the inspiration to go out there every night because of the people that I'm doing the show with. It's really not about the role. It's really not. I mean, that definitely helps when you have a more role, a bigger role that you can be creative in, like the one we're getting ready to do here. That really helps fire the creative juices. But when you do, and you're doing 8 shows a week, and it's the second show on a Sunday night, and mm-hmm. you're like, how can I do this again? Mm-hmm. You look around at everybody that's there with you, and you're like, okay, we're in this together. It's a team. I get an inspiration when I look at Katie on stage, and she's there, and I look around, and another actor is in the scene, and it just lifts, everybody kind of lifts each other up when they're out there in the moment.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I feel like it's, and that's the best way to approach it, because you're not relying on your childhood scars or
right.
your dreams mm-hmm. deferred or anything like that. You're in the moment and mm-hmm. you're trying to access yeah. emotions that are there and present, and you're with the audience. Not always happens, but mm-hmm. it's the best way to kind of be healthy about it. In that
yeah.
sense.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's yeah. how you endure
yes.
or
mm-hmm.
yeah,
persevere.
Yeah.
When you have a character
mm-hmm.
and, how do you do a lot of research? Like you're doing Cyrano, you're Cyrano.
Yeah.
Do you do a lot? And that's kind of a, oh, I don't know what you would call it. It's not a melodrama, but what is it? It's
more
stylized.
You call it a romance,
yeah.
I think, in sort of the definition where it's it's a classical text,
yeah.
Which means it's centuries old. It's originally a French text, so it's
yeah.
gone through a number of different adaptations. But it's classical in the sense that the language structure, it's written in a rhyming scheme and in a certain meter. It uses poetry as its text. And it involves, you know, swashbuckling and sword fights and big, long speeches of long, dense, kind of imaginative language. And all of those things give it a certain life and a certain sort of type of body that you might not get if you're doing something that's super contemporary that was written 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
has lots and lots of pausing, you know, and sparse language
yeah.
and is written in a sort of different vernacular.
So you really see a difference between, like, you know, let's take your role, John, with Cyrano, and then a role where, like, Death of a Salesman,
right.
something
right.
that was more realistic. So, first of all, let's just say, how do you inhabit this character? What do you do to
right.
prepare?
So Katie was talking about, you got to know the world of the play you're in. And so
mm-hmm.
you do research the play. You research
gotcha.
Who's done it. You research the language and how it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And every play, you're going to use the language a different way. I approach, because I do like classical theater and do mostly classical theater, I approach it from a text first. I go through and I look at the words people describe me and how I describe myself, and each scene you have an objective to go after, and what are you really – now, all that may change as you do the, as you get in and you start working with your fellow mm-hmm. actors and the director. But you kind of start there. You kind of you got to start with
mm-hmm.
what you want and what you're going after and the world of the play that you're in. The getting into character, I feel like that's the best approach, because you're going to find the characteristics and the psychological gestures and all that stuff as you mm-hmm. – you know, as you rehearse. So that's the first thing you do. You go through and kind of look what the script says
mm-hmm.
about your character and what
sure.
you say about your
yeah.
character and what you want in each scene and what your objective is and when you fail and when you succeed. And then you kind of build around that,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard because there's a lot of different ways to
yeah.
answer that question, you
cool.
know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about for you, Katie?
Yeah. So I would say first and foremost, like John is saying, you have to meet the story where it is. So, like, you know, it's sometimes helpful for me to think, explain it in terms of, like, genres very, very big right now in terms of television, right? Like, a show that is about vampires is going to be different than a show that's about the Wild West, that is different than something that streams on Netflix, that is different than CSI. Like, they all have different tones. They have different ways that they build structure and they tell the story. So your first job is to figure out the world that you're in and the type of story that you're telling, and that will determine sort of the type of toolbox that you need. For classical work, that's usually going to have a very specific type of language structure, which is going to involve a lot of different things than something that's newer, like we've already said. So the first thing is trying to figure out what the world of the play is, and that involves, I think, learning about when it's written and created, all the other productions, like John was saying. I guess to get real technical about it, what I would do is, you know, like with Cyrano, I had heard of the play. I had seen the Steve Martin movie Roxanne, and I knew sort of the loose, like, structure about it, just because it pops up so much that it. But I'd never really actually read completely, like, a full adaptation. So what I would do is read the adaptation that I'm given, probably once or twice for story, and then I would start reading it again from a character perspective, which is what do people – I'm playing Roxanne. What do people say about Roxanne? What does she say about herself? Do those things align? Do they not align? What do I know about women from this time period? I don't know that much about French culture at this time. I know a little bit, but how can I pull stuff from the actual world that will help me start to flesh out? Because our whole job is to take something that's on a piece of paper and breathe as much life into it as we can. That's all we're trying to do.
How much room do you have to kind of, because you have to flesh this person out,
right,
and you may not have all the direction or the information. So you've got to add some, you know. And then do you just add it? Do you just become extemporaneous? Do you ever portray the person differently from night to night?
I would say that with theater, one of the things you're trying to do is it's a collaborative art form. So you spend 3 to 7 or 8 weeks. I mean, not 8 weeks. In American theater right now, it's anywhere from 2 to 5 weeks in rehearsal. Our rehearsal periods are getting shorter and shorter because of budgets and stuff. But you use that time.
Hey, it's like hospital stays. Yeah. You know, the illnesses are the same. The need for competence is the same in theater, but the budget in the arts and medicine is diminishing.
It's diminishing.
Let's all go to France.
Yeah. Or at least in play form at Cyrano. In your rehearsal period, you work with a team, which includes designers, but most importantly, your director and your other actors. And you all try to discover the show together. I find that one of your main jobs as an actor is to figure out the language of your director and figure out if you both have the same vision for this type of person. Usually that will happen, ideally, before you get cast in something, and they will see you as the character, and you will see them as you will have the same artistic vision, I think. It doesn't always happen, but I think that would be ideal. And then you discover the character and the world together through talking, through rehearsal, through trying to say, I think this about this moment. Do you feel that as well?
So it gets molded. So
it
the
gets
director.
Molded together.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And then you come and then they sand it off a little bit and say, no, do a little this,
right,
a little
that.
Right,
and they're your outside eye. I mean, in theater, it's not film, so we can't watch ourselves back. We need somebody else to say, you know, it looks like you're doing this, so that I can say, that's not my intention. I have to change what I'm doing because I'm wanting to do something else. Yeah. I need somebody else to be my eyes, you know? And you shape it until you open it, like when you open the show. And then I think in theory, it changes a little bit each night because we're human beings and we're not robots and it's the theater. But you do kind of carve out this pathway or this river, and the boat can kind of like float.
Yeah.
But if you
get
if you park the boat, if you dock it and you get out and you walk through the forest, like
it's not gonna
you can't do that. You know, then the director or the stage manager will come back and say, that's not the show we've created. You have to get back on your track.
Let's get a little specific here, John. Have you ever had a character that you were playing, had to play, that you struggled with, you had a hard time with?
Yeah, so I feel like I struggle with every one. It's a constant communication with your actors that you're with and directors. There's always that struggle to find the emotional world, I think, of the characters you're playing. I think every character I've played, there's a struggle. And that's what's exciting about it, because it is something you get to figure out and you get to kind of play around in and see how that makes you feel and see how this character would would react to a certain situation that would be different or the same, how I, John Keebler, would react. And it's also, but you know it's in a safe place. You know it's in this arena where you can walk away when you're done with rehearsal and go home and be who you are. And then the next day you struggle with these things. And in that struggle, in that conflict, which is what makes theater and story so compelling, it's conflict that makes things change and makes mm-hmm. things interesting. So every character is a struggle, and that's what you want, because if it was easy or not, you know, interesting, you wouldn't dive into it a certain way. So every character I've struggled with to figure out mm-hmm. what he wants, what he's yeah. doing, the emotional world. Yeah, so that's
which,
how it is.
Which I think is good. I think if you're not struggling, yeah. I feel like you're probably not getting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, how could that be? Yeah.
Right.
How could
like,
you just slide into somebody's
yeah.
persona?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so night after night, you're realizing the fruits of your labor by you've done all this work to inhabit this mm-hmm. person. And let's say has it ever happened to you where it was emotionally very, very unusually draining mm-hmm. because the person you were playing somehow either triggered something in you, something was tough. Have you ever had that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. Yeah, and I think, I guess, yes. I mean, I absolutely have. I'm thinking about it in terms of because, you know, every story and every person and experience is different.
But
and,
I mean really
yeah.
tough.
Yeah, I mean, so the toughest, I would say the toughest role that I had was recently within the last 2.5 years. It was a show that I did in 2016 called An Octoroon. And we did it in the summer of 2016, and then we remounted it with the same team. All the actors are the same with the exception of one actress, and same director, same theater, same set, same costumes. Mm-hmm. It was a real remount the following summer. And the role was really, really challenging.
Because
sometimes I think it's the type of spots that you land in, but I have had a number of different challenging roles, but that one in particular was so challenging because it wound up being deeply, deeply personal in a way that that was just made me extremely vulnerable. And
I think we need to specify.
Yeah.
So people understand.
Yeah,
it was
course.
About...
So. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the play...
I watched you on YouTube.
Oh, God.
I checked
Nobody
it out.
Nobody looked that up.
I checked out the play.
Yeah. Okay, so the play is called An Octoroon. And it's a play called, by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. And it is a contemporary play. It's an adaptation of an older play called The Octoroon by Dion Boucicault, which was written a couple hundred years ago. And so the play is contemporary, but it revolves around a classical text. And... I don't think I explained this too
much.
When
you say it's contemporary, mm-hmm. people aren't acting like it's 1984 or something.
Well, it is. So this play was a little bit of both. I'll try to sort of truncate the explanation.
Oh, I did see it. It's
yeah,
this
but the play that I did was called An Octoroon, and it is based on the experience that the playwright had of adapting the play The Octoroon. He adapted it for the first time a couple years ago, and there was a workshop of it in New York, and it didn't go very well. People left the production. It got panned in the Village Voice, and he went away and went to therapy and then wrote...
He went to therapy.
Yeah, and then...
It's about slavery and racism.
Yeah, the original text revolves around a plantation that's on the brink of foreclosure, and... a distant nephew who comes in to try to save the plantation and falls in love with the plantation owner's daughter, who is 1/8 African-American and doesn't know about her own – she knows about her heritage, but she is unaware that she is still technically a slave, that her papers have never been signed. So she's sold into slavery to save the plantation. That's the original text. The play that I did has the original text in it. It additionally has a framing device – which is a new contemporary character of the playwright who is in therapy talking about his experience of doing the play. This probably sounds a little strange, but it makes for a fantastic theatrical experience. But what that character does with the playwright is he inhabits all of the roles that are absent actors because they've dropped out. So there's a number of men that are donning white face, black face, and red face to play all of the characters in the original text,
yeah.
and all of the women just play the characters in the original text.
And
that it was about race.
And I heard, not you, but mm-hmm. I heard another actress from another city mm-hmm. on YouTube say the lines that you had mentioned to me that yes. were so personally degrading, sort mm-hmm. of like out damn spot.
Yeah.
And, you know, like mm-hmm. she was cursing her 1/8 African-American
yes. yeah.
part of her. And I think for you, mm-hmm. how did that feel?
Yeah, well, so there's a number of sort of really difficult, rough speeches in the original text where you read them as a person now, and it's it's shocking and upsetting. It's language about being the mark of Cain and being the devil and having she's trying to show somebody that she's fallen in love with her. She's trying to tell him, I'm not good enough. Look at these markings on my body. I'm poison. I'm a snake. I'm disgusting. And, you know, that's not how I feel about my own heritage or my own race. That's not how I, you know, that those are not the feelings that I carry around. But in order to access and be truthful in those moments, you really do have to treat everything with absolute honesty and sincerity. And to be able to absorb those things and allow your brain and your heart to feel those ways in those moments is something that is really, really difficult. And stuff that maybe I think I had to acknowledge that, while I would say I don't consciously have, you know, that there are strains within yourself that you can recall certain things that are either similar or the same or,
yeah.
you know, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, psychologically speaking, triggers mm-hmm. are things that go deep mm-hmm. for one reason or another. And all the things you were mentioning, plus I think the second time you did the play mm-hmm. was in the Trump era.
Yeah.
Which
mm-hmm.
makes it even more challenging
mm-hmm.
For you
yeah.
to play that role. Mm-hmm. And your heritage is from...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my father's from Palau. It's a small island near Guam.
Yeah.
And my mom is, she's from California. She's Italian and Scottish, but she's American.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm mixed. I'm a mixed race person. And, you know, race in this country is something that for me has been a real big learning process. I have an immigrant father who comes from another country who wasn't necessarily raised here with the same sort of either ideas about race or understanding sort of where he fits or where we fit sort of in the scheme here. I find that the character of Zoe, who was the person I was playing, is something that I really identified with because she is somebody who sat at the intersection of race in a way where everybody either demands that you to either know your blood or demands to define you by your blood.
Yeah.
And in the way that I experience, which is where people want to define you by looking at you on the street. Any mixed race person that I know, I feel like can talk about how on the bus, at the movie theater, at a restaurant, people you don't know come up to you and say, what are you? And
yeah.
And then you're supposed to answer for your own place, either in the space or in the world, and sometimes your answers are or are not enough for them, which I find also being a mixed-race person who has a father that is from a country that nobody has heard of,
yes.
You know, like, has just provided for my entire life, I think, a lot of confusion. I was also raised in a predominantly white community, a very affluent community. And I think it was a lot of, at a time when people, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, when it was considered, at least in that community, PC to not talk about
yes.
race or to not talk about things or say that you didn't see these things.
Yeah.
I wasn't really raised with, I think, a lot of tools to understand how to have a discourse about that in a safe, sort of productive way. I sort of had to come to that through my own communities and my own adult life. And the show, having to do that show, really kicked up a lot of these, a lot of that stuff. I mean, the first time we did that show, I felt like I was in fourth grade for the entire process up until the last four performances, where I didn't know how to advocate for myself. I didn't know how to have a calm conversation about it. I didn't know how to basically do anything except either cry or be a bad actor. I sort of lacked the ability to do my job, is what I would say, which is nobody wants to watch people just cry to themselves on stage. You want to watch people tell a story and do things and be active. But I didn't really have – I wasn't really able to do that. I sort of I didn't feel like I was.
You were able to complete the run.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you were called back for the second
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like it's a very personal – I mean, artists are deeply critical of ours. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, so I have no idea what it was like to watch those things. But I would say I really understood how to survive in it through doing it. And then I have never been more grateful to come back to something.
Surely, you know, someone you have thought that Zoe herself was in turmoil.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
You were in turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
Your turmoil maybe had a different storyline, but it was really the same about race.
Yeah, it winds up, exactly. And I guess to answer sort of the original, maybe now that I've rambled for so long, but the hardest thing was to stand on stage and say all of those really deeply hurtful things and to know that people in the room had felt them about themselves, including maybe me, other people on stage, to know that they were angry about it, to know that people would be laughing because they felt so uncomfortable or they were so angry at you for saying those words. And you just really had to sort of do your job.
Oh, and it was a controversial play.
Yeah.
Because some people would take it sort of literally. I mean, that's a
tough
one. And you're saying all these self-denigrating things.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be some people of color, people, white people mm-hmm. who would be taking it in different ways, quite
right.
literally, don't, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way maybe to explain it or to be as clear without, you know, for people that haven't seen the show is that whatever
the show, we're talking about Ann Octoroon.
Right.
Okay, this has been, I noted, playing all over the country.
Yeah, all over the country.
Maybe we'll get it here.
Yeah, I mean, this one was at Woolly Mammoth in D.C. And, you know, doing that show in D.C. is different than doing it in Berkeley, is different than doing it in Portland. It's like it has a lot to do with the community. So anything that could be happening on stage, you know, people sit with different histories. And what I had experienced from my own communities coming to see the show was that it was hard for them because you could be seeing something horrific on stage that was hurting you and the person next to you was laughing. And that created a feeling of being unsafe and a feeling of being angry. And that's, I think that's just what the show is. And as our director would have said then, it was about pulling the rug up, like as if America had kicked all of its history underneath this rug and we pulled up the rug and we just kicked it out. Nobody solves anything.
Wow.
Nobody does anything about it. You know what I mean? But it's just what it is.
Well, this is just really interesting to me because politically meaningful theater is my favorite kind of
mm-hmm.
theater.
Absolutely.
Profound wisdom in theater is also you know, and the two aren't necessarily mm-hmm. together. But, John, have you ever played in a similar situation in a play that was – I know you do mainly classical mm-hmm. theater, but in a more contemporary play or contemporary rendition of it that is controversial?
Yes. Maybe not controversial, but I think it's so interesting to hear Katie talk about that because – being a heterosexual white male, I could never do that part. You know, my social identity is intact. Like the white male in this country they have their identity. That's you don't have to question that.
Top
dog. It's something that is just inherent by your physical attributes.
Yeah.
So. The only thing that I personally could come close to is I just recently did It's a Wonderful Life at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, where I played Jimmy Stewart's character. I can't remember his name. George Bailey. Yes, George Bailey. And so what that made me do as an actor is question my life choices and question my life up to that point every single night. And when you're faced with this alternate reality like George Bailey is, to see what would have happened if you would have made certain choices. That was very hard to sit through because you do every night. The emotional structure of that play made me go home every night going questioning everything I've done up to that point.
Why? I mean, what were you questioning? Or what were you doubting? I'm getting personal here.
Yeah, yeah. I would say my questions about doing this as a career, my questions about relationships that I've had in my life, questions about the direction where I want to go if I don't want to do this career anymore, decisions I've made in my life that could have changed the direction of my life. So all of those things kind of sat with me every night in order to access that emotion. I had to kind of ask those questions of myself, my place in the world, man's place in the universe was that type of thing. And I think that's the type of play that, a white, anybody can do, but a white man really can't go to those other places, I don't think, that Katie was talking about earlier, because we've never had that type of social identity question.
Yeah, but your example is very, very
interesting.
Because I didn't know that, could happen, but I could see because of the questions in the play.
Yeah.
And then let's say you were, I don't know if anybody is as happily ensconced as this in their life choices. Probably all of us have questions of the road not taken, or should I be doing this? But by the way, it's really nice being older.
Yeah.
Because I certainly have a few years left and could do something a little different, but the big ones, the big decisions, like it's over.
It's overdone, yeah.
It's okay. But that is wow, that is really interesting. And what comes up to me when I hear both of your stories, they seem really different, but they're really similar in that how emotionally growthful it is.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm just thinking of somebody going every day to program computers, okay?
Yeah.
And so they're programming computers, and, maybe they're thinking, I hate programming computers, but they're not touching into great literature.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm-hmm.
all plays are great literature, but,
right.
The ones you were talking about are heavy duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I envy you in that way. Yeah. I mean, it's... It's fabulous that you get to do this. It's a little painful sometimes.
It is, but again, it comes back to that conflict of if we're not in conflict and asking these questions about ourselves, and the theater and acting allows you to ask those questions about yourself and be very honest, and with that, when you bump up against those questions and that struggle and that conflict, you do become, hopefully, a better person or a person that you want to become more than the other person that you were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people get to do that in their jobs because they're not for even bad stories have conflict where you have to ask questions.
Yeah,
right. It's the act of self-examining your own life, right? It's like that. Like, there's no actor that's not going to lead an unexamined life.
Right.
Because we're constantly, daily, hourly, having to examine our own existence.
And you're working with all these wise souls wiser for their let's say, life experience in the theater.
And their courage just to get out there and try it, just
and,
to do it.
Yeah. And you're not going to get rich.
Oh, God.
And you, it is, a life in the arts and in theater. Very few are the top stars and chosen. And the rest earn, barely livable wages. Or they don't make it at all.
That's the majority right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually a book because I once had a client who whose son was a struggling classical musician, and you go to a small high school in Juneau and you can be the best, and then he goes to a good college but it's a good small college and he's really good, but then he goes to New York, and he still has the dream. It's like the soccer player dream.
Mm-hmm.
Every high school soccer star probably wants to be a professional soccer star like you, John. But not the realization that it's a big world out there and you're competing with the whole world that wants to be an actor. My gosh, this is a good chance. I think we should take a little break now. This is a fabulous conversation, and let's let it sink in for a moment and take a musical break, and then Katie Teckel and John Keebler and I will be back real soon to talk some more about the psychodynamics of acting.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Katie Teckel and John Keebler. They are both here from the East Coast to play in Perseverance Theater's coming production, Cyrano de Bergerac. And what we've been doing is we've been discussing the nuances of inhabiting a theatrical role. And what I'd like to talk about right now is what it's like to leave it. Both in the evening, after the curtain goes down, as well as after the whole run. Mm-hmm. So, John, what do you think? How do you get out of your role? Or is there any problem going home and being you?
Yeah, the emotional world of each play is a little different, the emotional landscape. And so some plays you're able to let go a little bit easier than others. I mentioned It's a Wonderful Life I just played, and this one. These are deeply emotional worlds, and so leaving the play every night, I had to leave. I'm talking about It's a Wonderful Life, and so for this one too, Cyrano, I feel like I'm going to have to leave a little bit of time after I take off his nose to kind of let those emotions kind of filter through myself a little bit. The last few scenes of Cyrano are very... They call for both Katie's character and my characters, all the characters on stage, not only our characters, to be emotionally invested in the world. And so it takes a little bit. But again, I always go back to this family that we've created on stage together, and that we are going through this, and it's not a negative thing. The emotions that I try to find in the world are not negative things. They're a positive emotion coming from the people that I'm connected to with on stage. And therefore, it's almost a celebration of the fact that we get to do this story and that we get to have these emotions other than dredging up like past scars and ghosts, which can be helpful in a way too. And sometimes, I do sometimes to get an emotional place. My father is not in great health. I think about his passing or times that we've had and things that we may not be able to do anymore in order to get me going in a certain place, and then taking those emotions and applying them to the scenes that we're in. But I feel like it's from a positive emotional release, almost like you're going to a therapist talking about these things. Because if it's a negative, degrading yourself, oh, I'm horrible, this sucks, which we do as well. Hopefully, if you continue in the career, you get over that because you know it's not useful. Just like in life, you know it's not useful. So you get over that. And so that's how I deal with it. I feel like it comes from a positive place. I'm telling the story. These emotions are real and honest, and I love telling the story with these people, and therefore it's easier to kind of let it go at the end of the day.
So, like Cyrano, I mean, I haven't seen the play yet, and I, read the story and have seen it somehow, and like he has low self-esteem, to say the least, okay? He just thinks he's really ugly. Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't impact you at all? You don't, it doesn't...
Well, I personally, again, being a heterosexual white male, I've never really had to worry about and I have all my hair, and I'm so my appearance in the world has never been questioned. There's still things about myself that I've fought with and personality characteristics that I'm like that I still work on. I've felt shame. I have felt being embarrassed, by saying or doing certain things in the world. So I kind of attach it through there. We all have that shame that we live with just for being human. I mean, it's a strange thing that you're just being human. You have a little shame. But then also Cyrano is also he thinks very highly of himself too, which is a very psychological dilemma, because there's this man who is verbose and poetic and gallant, but also when the people are left the room, you can see him for what he is, and that's what I find very interesting is that the mask and the unmask, the shadow and the sunlight.
Mm-hmm. What's a method acting, and do you ever do that? What is it, John?
Method acting is a lot of these method actors, they feel like they have to subject themselves to a certain amount of similarities that the character that they're playing in order to get the truth.
Yeah.
And we all do that in some form, but most of the characters you play don't call for you to live on an island by yourself for 2 months to get loneliness. Like most of those characters don't really happen that way. You know, they're in the world that, you know, that you, it's a very familiar world, most of these plays that you're in.
Yeah. So. And I would say, like, the method is a technique that is, there's a number of different, like, ways that you could approach being an actor, right? And there are a number of different schools, sort of from different countries and different time periods, one of which is Stanislavski and Method, and a number of other ones that Meisner and just various teachers that have come up with templates that you could adopt of ways of rehearsing and getting what we would call getting into a character. And something like Method might mean that you treat, as John is saying, like you start to live in the world the way the character would have lived in the world. So, like, if you are playing an alcoholic and you are very method, you might wish to go on some kind of bender for like 2 or 3 days just to see what it feels like, and then recall those physical and or emotional memories in your own work. I would say that, of course, every actor is very different, but I think that term kind of gets thrown around and is used a lot more when it comes to film, because, you know, film and theater acting is very different. Both are, I think, really deeply necessary and involved really honest, truthful storytelling. But I do think there's a difference between capturing madness on a camera and having to create madness on a stage 8 times a week while protecting your fellow actors and your body and your voice. For example, like if you had a fight scene, on stage, you have to spend time crafting that fight scene so that you can complete it 8 times a week for however many months you need to do the show, and you need to keep your body safe and your partner safe. On film, if you have a fight scene, I'm sure everybody still needs to be safe, but you don't have the same kind of restrictions.
Yeah, right.
And I think that breeds a kind of environment where there are, I think, certain actors that will go to any length to get the shot, because you just need one shot, right? You don't need to do it 8 times a week.
Right.
So you can be drunk if you want to film a drunk scene. You can be treating people not as safely as you would be treating them just because you want to get the shot. It breeds a kind of environment that I think people are lauded for, because they go
absolutely.
So into character that people are we think that that's what it means to be an artist.
Yeah.
You know, and I personally just don't think it is. I think there's a difference.
So how do you let go? How do you let go of
Yeah, I think every show is really, truly different. I mean, for something like an Octoroon, you know, that is so emotionally draining. I mean, like John was saying, the story runs its course, you know, and so you spend so much time rehearsing it and learning it so that, in my view, you can kind of leave everything on the floor, or the stage. So if you run the course and you expend all the energy, I usually feel pretty fine. It's sort of when we're rehearsing or discovering things that stuff will sit with me a lot longer. You know, like I think there was a day.
It's unfinished.
Yeah, there was a day a couple weeks ago where we were, I think, working the last couple scenes of Cyrano. And we didn't get to finish them. We didn't get to really figure them out. We just sort of started dipping into the waters. And I think for both of us, it stirred up a number of there was just a lot of, like, energy that was left over. And I think a lot of thoughts nothing was really settled in the way that it's not in rehearsal. But when you're doing the show, you know, usually if you're allowed to run the course of the show, like, I usually find that just some time in the dressing room. I like to hang out in the dressing room usually. There's a cool down period that happens where my brain is just sort of awake for the next couple hours. And I personally like to unwind in the dressing room and then maybe or the bar afterwards. I mean, that's another thing is like
late
bar
hours.
Culture is real big in theater. Late hours. And just kind of like downloading about work and the show afterwards with your castmates is the way that I typically will unwind.
What a bonding experience. I mean, it's bigger than summer camp. The only thing I can think of is going to meditation retreats for 10 days or going to small professional workshops like on something like Gestalt where you are really letting it all hang out. And then the poignancy, the sadness, as it all dissipates, it just disappears.
Yeah.
So when you strike the set, when it's over, how does that feel?
Yeah, it's
John.
I mean, every show it is a small death. It really is a small death.
There's a mourning period.
Yeah, you know that you're never going to be in the same set of circumstances with the same people in the same place the same time ever again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that is powerful, and it's also something you celebrate because it does remind you that your life it's a dress rehearsal for your life. I mean, you are basically. One of these days, we're not going to be in the same place, the same people at the same time.
Oh, absolutely.
So live your moment, live your life, and have, you know.
It sounds very Buddhist that the world is illusory.
Yeah.
You know, that it would constantly be that all of a sudden, all the conditions of this existence just disappear after weeks and weeks of intensity and being together.
Yeah, and there is a, you know, and of course, not every show is the same. There are some shows where you're like,
I'm glad
3 hours till I see these, you know what I mean? And then we're out. It's like cleaning up your station before, you know what I mean? Like, there's some shows where it's fine.
It's fine to be over. It's fine to be too sentimental about it.
Exactly. It's
some,
like,
some are more touching than others. And you know, and for both of you, you're far from home. You're far from, you know, your buddies or husband or wife. You're in this bubble for weeks that you know, and then eventually Anchorage bubble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it really is over because the place, when you're in D.C. doing a show,
I mean,
you know, you ain't going to go back to Kansas anymore here.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's one of the really, beautiful gifts of this type of work and this type of job is that, I mean, that was one of the reasons, you know, I took this job was like, when else would I go to Juno?
Absolutely.
You know? And additionally, like, when else would I play this part or with these people? And so that becomes part of the choices that you make, you know? And it's a gift. It's a real gift of 3 months, you know, that I think, for me, you're willing to say, okay, I'll go away from home to do this. Because, you know, being in D.C. anyway, you don't have, you know what I mean? Like, there's other stuff that you could do. I could stay home and do something different. But it felt really special to say yes to it because I knew that it was going to be a personal. Anytime that I have done that, I feel like it's been a very personal, rewarding time to go live someplace that I wouldn't live for 3 months. You know, so different, and you learn stuff about yourself. I mean, each time you do, like we're talking, you do a role, but specifically, like you go out of town or you have an experience. I mean, you are changed. You learn something. You learn new parts that things about yourself, or you remember parts about yourself. And I mean, it is a gift, you know.
I always wondered how we get such good people coming for perseverance. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we all know that coming to Alaska is definitely a different experience. But it's almost cross-cultural. I mean, you know, some people get confused when you're overseas and you say you're from Alaska and they think you're from a different country. But for me, having lived overseas, I remember I was kind of excited about moving to Alaska 37 years ago because, in my mind, because I'd never been here before, from Chicago, I thought, oh, well, you know, I really miss living in Nepal, but now I get to live in Alaska.
It's an adventure.
It's such a cross-cultural adventure, and it's so different.
Yeah, and it is different than visiting someplace. You know, I mean, we're only living here for 3 months, but, you know, that's more than 2 weeks. It's like we get the chance to meet local people and get to know people who live here, and, you know, it's a real, it's so special.
And your cast, many Junoites are in the cast.
Yes.
So that's really cool because you are meeting locals.
Absolutely.
And they are taking care of you in the sense that, you know, you They show you the hot spots and yeah, the very cold ice caves.
Yes.
John, have you been to an ice cave?
I have. We all went
our
first day off.
On our Monday, yes.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
And the people here have been so
wonderful.
Oh,
my God, yes.
The people, not only in our cast, but just people we're meeting in town. Just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
So it feels cross-cultural, but they've definitely accepted us into your culture. So thank you, all you Junoites, as you call it.
Oh, well, it's almost time to close. Mm-hmm. And we have really touched upon the rewards of an acting career.
Mm-hmm.
And, John, you mentioned that sometimes, you know, when you go back, when you're home after after playing somebody who's questioning their life, and you start getting into it. How have you been feeling right now, John? I'm going to ask about your career choice. You know, being in Juno.
I think it was a great choice.
Yeah,
I get to play with these emotions and meet these wonderful people and have these experiences, and that's what I think ultimately comes down. At the end of my life, I'm going to look back and I'm going to be like, I may not have a very big, money in my bank account, but I'm rich in other ways.
Which is, I can assure you, way more important. Absolutely. When it comes down to it.
Absolutely.
And you said you travel to D.C. periodically, so that means that you have probably a little acting community there.
Yes, I'm still in contact with some of the actors that I've worked with down there when I was doing a show down there. Mm-hmm. And now even more with Katie and Eleanor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have another actor from
Oh, that's our director.
Director. Your director,
yeah,
Eleanor.
Me and Eleanor are both from D.C.
And Katie, I know you've been away from your husband and away from your other work for quite some time. Can you imagine in a couple of years wanting to come back here to do a play?
I mean, I absolutely can.
Oh,
I mean, right now I was walking around on the water taking pictures, and the only thing I could think was like, God, I want to see it in the summer.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's so gorgeous right now, but it's like, yes, I absolutely can.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great note to end on. And I want to thank both of you, Katie Teckel and John Keebler, from the East Coast, for your insights into the emotional life of actors. And for us non-thespians, your descriptions of the work you have to do to be in and out of character have been really, really fascinating. So thanks for coming in. And I know this is your one day off during your hectic rehearsal schedule. And I'd like to also give my deep thanks to Jeff Brown, who for so many years, and I asked him how long we've been doing this, and he said many years. We can't even remember. He's really deftly operated the technology that makes this show happen, as well as providing consistent encouragement for my efforts and reminders to turn in my monthly announcement so that he can put it on the radio. And, of course, thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Please join us for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening next month. Good night.